We are in Genesis. We're not going to be here for too terribly long today, next week, and then we're going to lickety-split on through the Old Testament. But we are going to be looking at Abraham today. However, we did not quite finish with some really important information last week, and so we're going to pick up with that as we survey the Bible. The page numbers are referring to a book. It's called The Big Picture. There's a copy of it out in the foyer, but there's also printed material, 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, front and back, to kind of supplement what we're going to be talking about. The main book we're going to be using is our Bible. That's the important one. That's the one you really need. Let me remind you of what Genesis 12, 1 through 3 say. Genesis 12 make these magnificent promises to Abraham. These are epic verses as they lay out the remainder of not just the book of Genesis, but really the whole Bible. And there were three promises made to Abraham, and we often summarize them as land, nation, and seed. What is the land promise? Canaan. What is the nation that is going to inhabit that land? Israel. And ultimately, the seed promise is referring to Jesus. Those three promises were made to three patriarchs. That's the term we used to use a lot. Fathers. The three fathers. We're familiar with the idea of the father of our nation. And who is that? George Washington. Who's the father of Israel? Abraham. Really, there are three fathers. Abraham, then his son Isaac, then his son Jacob. I sing the song with the little kids. Once there were three patriarchs. Abraham, Ham, Zach. Jacob. And that's what we're going to be spending our time talking about next week and this week, this morning. However, I needed to finish talking about Genesis 1 through 11. And what we emphasize, and I know this is review for us in this study, and that's what we're intending to do, just go through this rather quickly. When you divide up Genesis, there are two basic parts, Genesis 1 through 11, and there are five narratives in there. Chapter 1 talks about creation, chapters 2 and 3 together, Adam and Eve, and that would include the fall. What about chapter 4? We didn't talk about it last week, but what happens in chapter 4 after Adam and Eve leave the garden? What happens between their sons? Cain kills Abel, and that's chapter 4. Chapters 6 through 9 all go together, and they are about Noah and the flood. And then in chapter 11, just 9 verses, Genesis 11, 1 through 9, the Tower of Babel. And those five stories are presented, alternating between them are genealogies. That's the structure. Story, genealogy, until you finally get to the end of chapter 11. And really, the story of Abraham begins in the middle of chapter 11 with a genealogy, starting in verse 10. But we're going to divide it up in this way. We're going to say 12 through 50 is the second half. 12 through 15. What we're going to try to talk about right now is the Abraham story, or as I'm going to call it here on the chart, the Abraham cycle. There's something really important in Genesis 12, verse 3. When God says, I will bless those who bless you, Abraham, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And here it is. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Who does that include? Just the Israelite nation? All families of the earth will be blessed. That is looking toward all humanity. When God created Adam and Eve, placed them in the beautiful garden, he had a relationship with them. We emphasized that last week. They had direct communication with God, the Creator. Anytime that God would come into the garden, We compared it to a little puppy dog coming and greeting you and saying, hey, I'm glad you're home. And that's how Adam and Eve seemed to have been until one day they didn't. And that was in Genesis 3 after they had sinned. And they had the issue with with the forbidden fruit. And we're all familiar with that. By the way, have I told y'all what the forbidden fruit was? Yeah, it was good to eat before the fall. A lot of people think the forbidden fruit was what?
An apple.
Well, it wasn't an apple. We're never told it was an apple. But what it was, in case you don't know, it was broccoli. And then after the fall, it turned into what it is today. So just so y'all know, I mean, yeah, I'm very, very glad to share that bit of information with you. Very important. All right, you see how chapters 1 through 11 are called the primeval history. What does that word primeval mean? Primeval history. Before history. It's prehistoric times. When did these events happen? We don't know. We don't know when creation was. We don't know when Adam and Eve lived. We do have a good idea of when Abraham lived. And that would be roughly placing it around 2000 BC, just to make it easy on us, around 1875 BC. And eventually you're going to have the Exodus in the 1400s BC as the events unfold. We're going to try to remind ourselves of some of those dates and remember them. Okay, the period of time that these cover are disproportionate. You just have a few chapters that cover thousands of years. We don't know how many thousands of years, or even more than that. What we do know, what we can approximate, is that from Abraham to the end of Genesis covers a period of about 300 years. Some of these fellows lived a long time. Abraham living, oh, I want to say 180, but these people did live a long time. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph lived to be 110 years old. I remember that. These folks lived a long time. Here's the important passage that we did not look at last week, and I want to remind us of it. When Adam and Eve sinned, God had a plan, didn't he? Why don't we take a look at Genesis 3:15? Extremely important verse, and that's why we're going to make sure we single it out. God is speaking to the serpent. We identify him as Satan himself, or I should say maybe John does in Revelation 12, that serpent of old, the devil. And it says here in verse 15, I will put enmity between you and the woman. This is God talking to the serpent. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. What I want to emphasize is that this verse is the first prophecy in the Bible. I mean, it's just Genesis 3. It's early after all. This is the first prophecy where God says, I will do this. I'm going to make this happen. What is he going to do? He's going to put this division between the seed of woman and the seed of the serpent. And then we try to identify what is that seed, what is that offspring, as the more modern translations render it. Well, this would be the line of Seth. Who ultimately is it referring to, do we say? It's ultimately referring to Jesus. And what is going to happen is that Satan is going to bruise Jesus' heel. How does he do that? How does Satan bruise Jesus' heel? We would say the crucifixion. But by hurting Jesus so terribly, Jesus was in the tomb for 3 days, and then he rises from the dead, never to die again. He overcomes sin by becoming the perfect sacrifice for sin. And so in that act, he crushes the head of Satan. And we say the resurrection is when that happened. And so all of this put together is describing the scheme of redemption. How did Moses, when he wrote this in 1400 BC, how did Moses know all this was going to happen? How did God know how everything was going to play out thousands of years before Jesus even came to the earth?
God was and is.
All right. Because God was and is and always will be. I like that answer. He is all powerful is really what you're saying in that expression. Omniscient. He knows everything. He is omnipotent. He is all powerful. God knew what was going to happen, and he is full of grace and mercy. Did he have to come up with this scheme of redemption? Of course not. But he did because he loves us, and he's always wanted that relationship. And that's what we really emphasized last week. So God creates this perfect paradise for humanity, and humanity says, no thanks. That's not what I want. I want to eat this fruit because I think it's going to help me be like God. And the devil deceived Adam and Eve. But then you've got these two lines. You've got the line of Seth. You've got the line of Cain. And the line of Cain is evil. The line of Seth becomes evil, doesn't it? And so you reach the point in Genesis 6 where all of humanity is evil. In fact, what does it say about all humanity? The Lord saw, this is chapter 6, verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Is that hyperbole? Yes. I don't think that's saying literally every single thought that every single person had was evil continually. Can you relate to that verse, though? Not you personally. Not that you think evil all the time. We live in a corrupt society, don't we? What did God do in order to start over, basically? With a flood, he started over and he saved one man and one family. But that's all the problem. No, because sin entered the ark, a sinful man Noah. He's called a righteous man, and he was, but he wasn't perfect, perfectly sinless. And eventually what you have, and I'm taking too long again, like I did last time, what you have is God trying repeatedly to have a relationship with all humanity, and he finally, it seems, what we have presented here is God saying in Genesis 12, I'm now going to focus on one family, on one man, and then his family. And that's what he does with Abraham. He enters into a covenant relationship with Abraham. So I'm going to go back to Genesis 12. I don't know how well you can see on the screen here, but you have way over on this side, Ur of the Chaldeans. And in the middle there, I put this nice little drawing of Ur of the Chaldeans. We think 2,000 years B.C., 4,000 years ago, humanity would be extremely primitive. No, they had the internet back then. No, they didn't. No, never mind. Were they just extremely primitive? Humanity's always been pretty smart. I don't buy into this idea of the caveman. It's cute for a commercial, I guess, or a movie. But I don't know that mankind was ever walking around with a stoop gait and grunting and, ooh, fire! Humanity... were smart. And they built sophisticated buildings and structures and cities. And what archaeologists have determined is that Ur of the Chaldeans was a sophisticated city by all accounts. And Abraham is being asked to leave his home and travel about 1,500 miles total. So he starts out from Ur, goes about 750 miles to Haran, and then he finishes that route. And these routes are trying to demonstrate the typical route that they would take, the highways as they were established. And so he starts a long journey. Did God tell Abraham, we make this observation with Abraham, did God tell him where he was supposed to go at first? I want you to leave Ur, and I want you to make your way over to Canaan. I will show you. So let's take a look at that together. And I feel like I can relate to Abraham in that way. And the reason why is because I have no sense of direction. I don't know where I'm going. My dad used to tell me, you should be able to tell somebody, oh yeah, I know how to get there because I've been there before. That doesn't mean anything to me, unfortunately. Now, Abraham, I'm sure, was a good navigator, but he was walking by faith, wasn't he? He was being led by the Creator. Let's read Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all families of the earth will be blessed. So let me point this out to you as we look at this. We're simplifying what's here in these verses, but you can see I'm going to lead you to a land. And we said just a few minutes ago, that's Canaan. We understand that to be the land of Canaan. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. At what point did they enter the land in those books, in those first five books of the Old Testament? When do they enter the land and conquer it and settle? They don't. When will the land promise be fulfilled? You have to go to the sixth book of the Old Testament, to Joshua. Then they will enter the land. All right, but the nation promise is fulfilled in Exodus. When you have a group, a family, Abraham, then his son Isaac, then his son Jacob. How many sons did Jacob have? 12 sons. And that small family grew into, it's estimated, 1 million people while they were in Egypt. And we'll look at that in a couple of weeks. But God was blessing them. All right, speaking of blessing, here is the seed promise. In you, Abraham, in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. All families of the earth. One of the most significant features of this promise is that when Abraham is given this magnificent, epic promise, how many children did he have at the time? Zero. Well, that's okay, because people have kids, and that's normal. But what was the problem with Abraham's situation? They were old. Not just a little. Abraham was 75 years old, the text tells us. In fact, that's right here. Where is that? Verse 4. Yeah, I'm looking right at it, and I know it's there. He was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. How old then is his wife? She's 10 years younger than him. So she is 65. Is that likely? Are they likely to have kids? And yet they do, don't they? How old was Abraham when he held the son of promise in his arms? Do you remember? 100. Which means Sarah, when she had her baby, was how old? 90. Is that amazing? Is that miraculous? That is the finger of God behind all of that. I want to pluck out a couple of verses here that I think are very interesting. This is some divine commentary on Abraham. This is Isaiah 51, verses 1 and 2, talking about Abraham and Sarah. Listen to me, you who follow after righteousness, you who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were hewn, and to the hole of the pit from which you were dug. Look to Abraham your father, and to Sarah who bore you. For I called him alone, and blessed him, and increased him. I like that. The rock from which you were hewn. Now that can also be said of God, but specifically it's being said of Abraham and Sarah. Look to Abraham. I called him, and I called him alone. I didn't focus on a lot of other people. I focused on one family, one man, one family. I called him alone, blessed him, and increased him. God called Abraham in Genesis 12. And he will eventually fade away from the picture, but his story goes through chapter 25. And you have Isaac then discussed briefly. He kind of gets the shaft. They don't really talk about Isaac much. He's overshadowed by his father, Abraham, and by his son, Jacob. And we'll talk more about that next week when we look at Isaac and Jacob together very quickly. We're focusing on Abraham right now. We looked at this chart recently on Wednesday night. We were talking about Mount Moriah in Genesis 22. And I don't know how well you can see the verses there. They're kind of small. The point is this. You can see the numbers, I hope, 1 through 7. This is God's appearances, recorded appearances to Abraham in Genesis. And you have God appearing to him 7 times across Genesis 12 through chapter 22. And again, the story of Abraham doesn't finish until chapter 25. Mainly, the narrative is in chapter 24. So Genesis 12 through 24 would be an easy way to remember Abraham's life story. And God appears to him over and over again. And these are all significant. Every last one of them is significant. I want to jump ahead. Let's turn in our Bibles to Genesis 17. We're going to jump ahead to appearance number 5. And I'm not trying to skip over 1 through 4. Actually, we've already looked at the first one, Genesis 12, 1 through 3. God enters into a covenant relationship with Abraham. He repeats the promises that he makes to him. But what is special about chapter 17? What does Abraham receive? The covenant. More specifically, the sign of the covenant that God makes between himself and Abraham. And what is that sign of the covenant? Circumcision. Now, Isaac will be born when Abraham is 100. In chapter 17, Abraham is 86. No, excuse me, 99. I'm getting my dates messed up here. He was 86 when Ishmael was born. And you can see from the verse I've highlighted on the screen that Ishmael is about to be emphasized. But Abraham is now 99 years old. And notice what verse 17, verse 1 says, how it identifies him. When Abram was 99 years old. We don't call him Abram, but that's what he's called from Genesis 12 through Genesis 17. God gives him the fuller name, Abraham, in this very passage right here. Look at verse 5. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. Abram would mean exalted father. It's a nice honorific term, exalted father. But Abraham is more appropriate because it means father of many nations. That's the significance of his name. Why don't we read verses 1 through 8? Let's just read these verses together. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Talking about who was, who is, and who is to come. I am El Shaddai. I am Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you and may multiply you greatly. And Abram fell on his face, and God said to him, Behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your offspring after you. And I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. So let's stop here for a moment. Is this what God wanted? To ignore all, and he's not going to ignore all the other nations, but to just say to all the other nations, you just do whatever. I'm going to focus just on Abraham and his family, and that's it. That's not what he wanted. my argument is he tried to have a relationship with everybody all at the same time, and it did not happen. This is plan B, so to speak. And this is also the means by which Jesus is going to come. It's the scheme of redemption playing out. Because Jesus is a direct descendant of Abraham. Of course he is, because he was a Jew. Yes, sir. Right. And there's no specific place that says this is the law for all humanity. You do have the law of Noah that's established, and the covenant that God made with Noah. And it does talk about, for example, capital punishment and Genesis 9. So there is this law. The argument is often made that there's this universal law that's just been written into our DNA, as it were, that we understand innately what is right and what is wrong. Today in the sermon, I'm going to be talking about our conscience. And our conscience is a warning system to guide us. But what we have is the divine revelation from God. The Gentile world, did they have a divine revelation from God? The non-Jews? No, they didn't. And yet, what does Paul say in Romans 1? You guys are off the hook. That's okay. They knew from creation. One of the arguments Paul makes in Romans 1 is that homosexuality is sinful. And he said his argument is from nature. He says God made Adam and Eve. He made male and female. This is the natural order. That's his argument. And Paul condemns it elsewhere. But again, it's from nature. And that is an important argument. When people deny the existence of God, they are, I mean, and I know I'm slanted toward this particular view, but I just look at how fearfully and wonderfully we are made, how magnificent our bodies are, how incredible our world is, and say, how could anyone think this wasn't designed by an all-powerful being? Do we really think this all happened by chance? Or as the mythological stories of creation say, we just, boom, we were created out of water, out of the sea or mud or whatever. What the Bible presents to us, as we already saw last week, is that there is an all-powerful being who created us and did so because he wanted a relationship with us. Does that address your question at all? And of course, I think you already knew that answer. Well, look here in Genesis 17, in verse 17. This is after God has just told him, hey, you and Sarah are going to have a son. And Abraham goes, wait a minute, we already solved that problem. When I was 75, you said we were going to be the father of a great nation. I didn't have any kids, so Sarah and I took matters into our own hands. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. What did they do? What did Abraham and Sarah connive? That Abraham would father a child through Hagar, Sarah's handmaid. That seemed to be a practice then, when the wife couldn't have children. And so what he says here is, God, wait a minute, I've got a 13-year-old son here. Oh, that Ishmael might live before you. He's the son of promise. And what is God's answer in verse 18? I'm sorry, in verse 19. No, but Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son. You shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him. What's the problem? Abraham is 99. Sarah's 10 years his junior. That means she is 89 years old. How is this going to be possible? What is the answer? God, with God, all things are possible. The name Isaac, what does it mean? Laughter. Why? Why is he named that? Because they laughed. Well, in the next chapter, this is appearance number 6. you have the Lord come to them and say, this time next year, you're going to have a baby. This time next year. And that's when they laugh. And he said, this isn't possible. How can this possibly be? Verse 12. Sarah laughed to herself. This is Genesis 18, verse 12. Sarah laughed to herself, saying, after I'm worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure? The Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm too old? And here it is. Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah will have a son. Is anything too hard for the Lord? It doesn't emphasize it in my side column reference, but in my side column reference, it mentions a note there on verse 14. Is anything too hard for the Lord? It mentions Luke 1, verse 37. I want to go over to Luke 1, verse 37 for just a moment. We looked at this on the Wednesday night, if you recall, that we studied about Abraham and Isaac and Mount Moriah. The angel Gabriel is talking to a young virgin by the name of Mary. What did he just tell Mary? Hey, you're going to have a baby. She's like, that's not possible. I'm a virgin. I'm not married yet. And he explains to her that the Holy Spirit will come upon you. The power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the child to be born will be called holy, the Son of God. And behold, your relative Elizabeth, in her old age, has also conceived a son. This is the sixth month with her who was called barren. Here it is, verse 37. For nothing will be impossible with God. Nothing will be impossible with God. That doesn't sound exactly like Genesis 18, verse 14. In my side column reference for Luke 1, verse 37, this is what it has. Cited from Genesis 18, verse 14, and then it has in parentheses, GK period. What does GK period mean? Greek. What that's saying is the people who translated the Hebrew Old Testament into the Greek Old Testament, and we often refer to that as the Septuagint. That's a simplistic term, but that's a great way to just summarize it and say, hey, you go from the Hebrew Old Testament to the Greek Old Testament. And that's what the New Testament authors often quoted from. And sometimes it's worded a little differently. So I'm trying to alert us to this reality. But what's really special here is that in Luke 1, verse 37, it quotes word for word what the Greek Old Testament says in Genesis 18, verse 14. This is an allusion. This is it's a quotation. In Luke 1, verse 37, when Gabriel's talking to Mary about her son's miraculous birth, and channeling Sarah and Abraham. But what does Gabriel also talk about in the previous verse? Verse 36. Your relative Elizabeth in her old age has conceived a son. This is the sixth month with her who was called barren. What's that about? Who's Elizabeth? The mother of John the Baptist. And what was unusual about John's birth? His folks were old. So as amazing as it was that Abraham and Sarah were old and had a baby, a son of promise, that Zechariah and Elizabeth had the forerunner of Jesus, John the Baptist, and they were old. They are outshined, though, are they not, by a young virgin, probably just a teenager, who had never had sex. And yet here she is, pregnant with the Son of God. This is a basic tenet of our faith. We believe in the virgin birth. And this is how it's presented to us in Luke 1. Nothing will be impossible with God. And it's all going back to Abraham. And this promise that God made to him, in you all nations of the earth will be blessed. How is that going to be possible when Abraham is so old? I mean, when he's cold and given these promises, he's 75 years old, doesn't have any kids. Ishmael is born when Abraham is 86. He is given this promise. Well, in a year from now, you're 99. When you're 100, you'll have this son of promise, Isaac. Forget Ishmael. I mean, don't forget him, but he's your son. Did Abraham love Ishmael?
Yes.
Yes. Did Sarah love Ishmael? Not so much. Because she saw him as a rival to her own son. Well, then finally you have Isaac born. Here is this incredible journey that Abraham has taken with the Lord. From Genesis 12, being called in Haran, traveling 1,500 miles, finally getting there, going, and we've just skipped over a lot of the details about the ups and downs of Abraham, and finally he gets this son of promise. Isn't it amazing, the journey that he has taken? And then we have the seventh and final appearance. And what does God ask Abraham to do with that son that he worked so hard to have? What? Does that make any sense? This is what I want you to do. That son that we worked so hard for you to get. Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love. Go to the land of Moriah and offer to him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I shall tell you. Yes, sir. Okay. It was always God's way. Now, you say that, and yet you make it sound like, we make it sound like Abraham did sacrifice Isaac. But he didn't. And yet he did. In his mind, he had. This is crazy, isn't it? And I hope in some small way, as we've walked through this journey that Abraham has, however briefly, that it helps us to appreciate how mind-boggling this is. Where's Larry? Oh, yeah, he's back there teaching class. I'm going to cite a verse from James. You'll let him know, right? Of course, now 1 Samuel's his favorite book in the whole wide world, because that's what he's teaching. James 2, verse 23, gives us some divine commentary on Abraham and his situation. The scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, it was counted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. Yes, ma'am. Okay. It was to prove that Abraham loved God as much as God loves us. Did God not know that Abraham loved him, though? Did God go... Because at the end of the Genesis 22, as the knife is raised and Abraham's about to come down and kill his son, the knife is stayed, and God says, No, don't do that. Now I know, Abraham, that you're committed to me. I'm not remembering the exact words. And we need to go back to Genesis 22 here in a moment. Verse 12, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything harm to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. I didn't know, but now I do. Well, I thought we said a moment ago God was omniscient. I thought he knew everything. So what's going on? Okay, all right. Here's a lousy illustration. I knew Tom Brady was going to lead the Buccaneers to the Super Bowl and win. I'm from Tampa. I knew that was going to happen, but they still had to play the game, didn't they? And it was a great game, by the way. It was really, really good. Bucks won the Super Bowl. This is a little more important than that, I guess. Yes, ma'am. Okay. And God is going to do something like that for us as well, to solidify our faith. Yes, sir.
What's interesting for you, Wilson? You said this is the seventh time.
The seventh time, the seventh appearance recorded.
Yeah, I believe this is the ultimate test. So I think it's a process that gives Abraham time to develop
Yes, sir. This gave Abraham had time to develop his faith. I'm repeating it for everyone. Go ahead. Okay. So are we going to prove to be a friend of God as we endure the tests? Do you ever feel like you've gone through a test? A trial? Lately? Anybody? Has anything happened to you lately? Yeah, I see some hands here. Are you a friend of God like Abraham was? What if Abraham had first met God? God had first appeared to him and said, "Hey, Isaac. Hey, Abraham. You've got this son of yours that they had through natural means." And said, "Hey, why don't you sacrifice for him and prove to me your loyalty?" What do you think Abraham would have done then, right off the bat, if he didn't have 20, 25, 30 plus years of a relationship with God and gone through this whole ordeal of trying to have a son and finally having that son? I think he would have told God, "Take a hike." Yes, sir. So God knew Abraham was going to do this. And what was that last part? Right. All right. This message might have been for Isaac. That's the part I wasn't hearing. Absolutely. And of course, it's also for us. We're gonna make some quick application here in a second, but think about this. This is as much for us as it was for Abraham and Isaac. Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love. John 3:16 says, "God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son." Did God love Jesus? Take your son, your only son. God did that. He took his son and offer him as a sacrifice. Abraham walked through that. What about God? Did he sacrifice his son? All right, Abraham, you got the knife up high, you're about to bring it down, and don't do that, don't. But did God stop the knife from coming down and killing his own son? So what's the parallel here? Is the sacrifice of Isaac anticipating the sacrifice of Jesus? Where's the book, chapter, verse that says that exactly? Well, it doesn't. But it's pretty obvious, isn't it? And this Genesis 22 is 1,800 years before Jesus ever came to the earth. Before it was even thought about, this idea of crucifying the Son of God. How did God know this? This story. Do you think there are other events in the life of Abraham that could have been recorded? Other challenges that he faced? Sure, but this one's pretty important, and it's the climax of the Abraham story. It's the ultimate emotional climax. And God says, "Now I know." So very yes, ma'am. Right. Yeah, and when we were together on Wednesday night, we read from Hebrews 11, but you have that right there. So Abraham had in his head, if I do kill this son, I know God can raise him from the dead. He didn't understand what all was going on here. And only now do we try to guess and figure out what was going on. By the way, there was a sacrifice made on that altar, and it was a ram that God provided, and we talked about that. That word provide and the connection that has with providence, where God sees what we need before we need it and provides for us. That's what providence means. So let's look at these very quickly. We're really out of time. It's time. I'll just mention them and then we'll quit. Your close relationship with God is going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight. After these things, God tested him. Genesis 22, verse 1. We need to learn from our mistakes. Ishmael was not the son of promise. I was about to say he was a mistake. I'm not saying that. But they were trying to help God out. Does God need our help? No. But can he use our mistakes and make them into something beautiful and wonderful? And this last one I'll make, I should have taken more time to talk about these. Trust God even when nothing else makes sense. So when the servants are saying, hey, what's going on here? You and I are going to go on to Mount Moriah and leave us behind. Then he says, don't worry, I and the boy will come back to you. Abraham had faith. He knew that somehow he and Isaac would come back. Even though Abraham was the only one who knew at that time, he was supposed to sacrifice his son. All right, we're going to continue the story next week as we look at the three patriarchs, Isaac and Jacob, to finish out Abraham. Thank you for your participation this morning. I hope this is helpful.